Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're diving deep, really deep, into a literary titan, Alexandre Dumas, the Count of Monte Cristo.
Oh, fantastic choice.
It's just this incredible epic, isn't it? Full of betrayal, vengeance, and ultimately this profound transformation.
It really is. And epic barely covers it. The sheer scope. Decades, dungeons, Parisian high society.
Yeah.
It really digs into justice, revenge, what makes us human. Definitely stays with you.
Absolutely. Okay, so before we jump into the story itself, let's get some context. We're talking Alexandre Dumas, Père the Father,
mm-hmm.
a giant of 19th century French literature, smack bang in the middle of the Romantic movement.
Right, that era of high emotion, individualism, big historical sweeps.
Exactly. And Dumas himself, what a life. Son of a Haitian-born French general, rising from, well, pretty humble beginnings to become this huge literary star. I think the Three Musketeers, too.
His life was almost as dramatic as his plots.
Totally. And his style, dynamic plots, larger than life characters, it was perfect for serial publication, wasn't it?
Oh, definitely. Monte Cristo ran from 1844 to 1846, published in installments, kept readers absolutely hooked.
You had to wait for the next part.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently it was inspired by a true story, Pierre Picot.
Yeah, a Ron Shoemaker. Dumas took that kernel and, well, amplified it massively.
And the timing. Post-Napoleonic France, a really turbulent period.
Mm-hmm. Politically unstable, society kind of in flux. It's this perfect, rich backdrop for all the themes Dumas wants to explore. Ambition, betrayal, corruption.
It really sets the stage. So let's get into it. The story kicks off in 1815 Marseille.
Right, the port city.
We meet Edmond Dantès. He's young, just 19, first mate on the ship Pharaon.
And things are looking good for him.
Unbelievably good. He's about to be promoted to captain. He's days away from marrying his fiancée, the beautiful Mercedes Herrera.
You can almost picture it, can't you? His future seems completely golden.
Almost too golden, maybe, because trouble is brewing.
Oh, absolutely. Underneath all that promise, there's this nasty little conspiracy forming. Three men, basically.
Right. Walk us through them.
Well, first, you've got Danglars. He's the ship's purser. And he's just eaten up with professional jealousy over Edmund getting the captaincy.
Okay, envy. Who else?
Then there's Fernand Mondego, a fisherman. His motive. He's desperately in love with Mercedes and can't stand seeing her marry Edmund.
Unrequited love, a classic motive. And the third.
Caderousse. He's a neighbor, kind of weak-willed, maybe a bit greedy. He doesn't actively plot, perhaps, but he goes along with it. Too cowardly to stop it.
So envy, jealousy, cowardice. But there's a fourth person who really seals Dantès' fate, isn't there?
Yes, and he's arguably the most dangerous because he holds actual power.
Gerard de Villefort.
The deputy prosecutor.
Exactly. Ambitious, ruthless. He sees a way to protect himself and advance his career.
How does Dantès get tangled up with him?
Well, Dantès is carrying this letter, just doing an errand for his dying captain from the Pharaon. Totally innocent on his part.
But the letter. The letter implicates Villefort's own father, Noirtier, who's a known Bonapartist supporter. And Villefort, wanting to distance himself from any Bonapartist ties in this shifting political climate.
Sacrifices Dantès to bury the connection.
Precisely. He sees Dantès as collateral damage, burns the letter, ensures Dantès is locked away quietly.
It's chilling, and the arrest itself is just brutal.
Right at his wedding feast. Imagine the scene. Torn away from Mercedes, accused of being a traitor.
And then, no trial.
No trial. Whisked away, secretly imprisoned in the Chateau d'If.
That notorious island prison.
The place you supposedly never leave. His name, his love, his future, everything just gone. Condemned to a living death.
It's such a profound injustice. It sets up everything that follows, this idea of absolute ruin.
And then this almost unbelievable comeback.
Right, but it forces that question immediately. What happens to a man when everything is stolen? Does he want justice or does he want vengeance?
And is there even a difference in the end? That's the core, isn't it?
It really is. So Dantès is in the Chateau d'If. Years pass.
Years of solitary darkness. He plunges into despair, contemplates suicide. Utter hopelessness.
But then something changes.
He hears a noise, scratching, from the next cell.
Hope, or at least curiosity.
Exactly. And this leads him to Abbé Faria.
Ah, the Abbé, such a pivotal character.
Absolutely transformative. Faria is this brilliant Italian scholar, priest, thinker.
Yeah.
Imprisoned himself. Everyone thinks he's mad because he talks about treasure.
But he's not mad at all.
Far from it. He becomes Dantes' teacher, his mentor, almost a father figure in that dungeon.
What does he teach him?
Everything. Languages, history, science, philosophy, political theory. He sharpens Dantes' mind, turns his raw intelligence into something truly formidable.
And crucially.
Crucially, Faria helps Dantes piece together why he was imprisoned, who betrayed him. He connects the dots.
So now Dantes understands the conspiracy.
Yes. And just before Faria dies, he reveals the secret. The location of this colossal treasure hidden on the island of Monte Cristo.
Wow. So Faria gives him knowledge, understanding, and the means for his future.
Everything he needs. And Faria's death, tragically, becomes Dantes' chance.
The escape plan.
Ingenious and incredibly grim. He gets into Faria's burial sack.
Oh, right.
Sews himself in and gets thrown into the sea instead of Faria's body.
It's literally a rebirth, isn't it? Escaping from a tomb into the freedom of the ocean.
Absolutely. The old Edmond Dantes effectively dies there. What emerges is someone else entirely.
And the first thing he does is find that treasure.
He does. Unimaginable wealth. Mm-hmm. Gold. Jewels. Enough to make him one of the richest men in the world.
But he doesn't just rush off for revenge.
No, he's patient now. He spends the next decade traveling, learning, refining himself. Creating the persona.
The Count of Monte Cristo.
Mysterious, incredibly cultured, and possibly wealthy. But it's a mask, isn't it?
Completely. Underneath all that cool sophistication is this burning rage, this intricate plan. And he uses other identities, too.
Yes, like Lord Wilmore, the eccentric Englishman, Abbe Busoni, the Italian priest, Sinbad the sailor.
Why so many personas? What's the strategy there?
It's about access and information, I think. Each disguise lets him move in different circles, observe his enemies up close, gather intelligence without anyone connecting him back to Dantes.
Psychological warfare, almost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He becomes this almost omnipresent, unseen force manipulating things behind the scenes.
Before he unleashes his full plan on his main enemies, though, he does something different. Back in Marseille.
Yes. His first act is one of kindness, almost. He finds out his old boss, Monsieur Morel.
The ship owner who was always good to him.
Right. Morel stayed loyal, tried to help Dantes, but now he's facing financial ruin. And Dantes also learns his own father died of starvation, heartbroken.
Tragic.
So the Cuncher, disguised, secretly intervenes. He saves Morel's business, saves his family's honor.
Why do that first? What does it tell us about him at this stage?
I think it reinforces his view of himself as an agent of providence. He's not just there to punish the wicked. He's also there to reward the good. It sets him up as this figure who balances the scales.
Right. He believes he can wield this power for both reward and retribution.
A belief that gets seriously tested later on.
Okay, so after settling things with Morel, he turns his attention to Paris.
Where his three main betrayers have flourished.
Let's recap who they are now. Fernand Mondego.
Now, the Count de Morcerf. A famous general, respected military man, married to Mercedes.
Wow. And Danglars.
Baron Danglars, a hugely wealthy and influential banker.
And Villefort?
Still climbing. He's now the Procureur du Roi, the chief prosecutor.
Yeah.
Hugely powerful in the legal system.
So they've all achieved everything they wanted, built on Dantes' ruin.
Exactly. And into their glittering world steps the Count of Monte Cristo.
He becomes the sensation of Paris, right?
Utterly. His wealth, his mystery, his intellect. Everyone is fascinated. He plays the part perfectly. Patiently weaving his web.
And his revenge isn't just quick violence.
No, no. That's what's so chilling. It's slow, methodical, psychological destruction. He uses their own sins, their own secrets against them. It's like a dark symphony.
Let's break down how he takes them down. First, Fernand, the Count de Morcerf.
Right. The Count uses Haiti, his ward.
Yes, the daughter of Ali Pasha, a ruler whom Fernand betrayed and murdered years ago during his military service in Greece. The Count basically saved Haiti from slavery.
So Haiti holds the key to Fernand's dark past.
She testifies before the French government, revealing Fernand's treachery, public disgrace, ruin,
and his son, Albert.
Albert feels his family honor is stained, challenges the Count to a duel, not knowing who he really is.
But Mercedes figures it out.
She recognizes Edmund. She goes to the Count, begs him to spare her son. She reveals the truth to Albert.
How does Albert react?
He's horrified. Understands his father's crime, apologizes to the Count, and abandons his father's name and fortune, along with Mercedes.
So Fernand loses everything. His honor, his family.
Everything. The Count confronts him one last time, reveals his identity, I am Edmond Dantes, and Fernand, completely broken, goes home and shoots himself.
It's a brutal end. And it really speaks volumes about ambition built on lies, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How fragile that kind of success is.
Absolutely. A powerful critique of that kind of hollow status. Okay, next target. Danglar, the banker. Driven by greed.
And the Count uses that greed against him. He manipulates the stock market, deals in false information, plays on Danglar's financial schemes.
That bankrupts him.
Completely. Danglars tries to flee with stolen hospital funds, 5 million francs.
But the Count anticipates this.
Of course. He arranges for Danglars to be captured by Luigi Vampa, an Italian bandit chief who owes the Count.
And Vampa doesn't just hold him?
No, this is where the poetic justice comes in. Vampa starves him, charges him exorbitant prices for food and drink, draining away that stolen 5 million, franc by franc.
Just like Dante's father starved.
Exactly. It's a perfect mirroring of his sin. Eventually, Danglars is broken, repentant. The Count reveals himself, then lets him go penniless, but alive.
Interesting that he spares his life. Why do you think?
Maybe living with the knowledge, stripped of everything he valued, is a worse punishment for someone like Danglars than a quick death. Or perhaps the Count is starting to question the finality of death as a punishment.
That's possible. Which brings us to Villefort, the man who actually condemned him. This revenge seems the most complex.
Oh, definitely the most intricate and devastating. The Count orchestrates multiple lines of attack.
Like bringing Villefort's past sins literally back to life.
Exactly. He finds Benedetto, the illegitimate son Villefort had with Madame Danglars years ago, whom Villefort tried to bury alive as an infant.
You what?
Tried to bury him alive. The baby survived, rescued by others, grew up a criminal. The Count finds him, educates him slightly, gives him a new identity as Andrea Cavalcanti, and introduces him into Parisian society.
Well, at the same time, things are imploding within Villefort's current family.
Yes. His second wife, Heloise, is a poisoner. She starts killing off family members, Villefort's first mother-in-law, trying to secure the inheritance for her own son, Edouard. She even poisons Villefort's beloved daughter, Valentine.
But the Count says Valentine, right? He knows about poisons.
He does, secretly giving her antidotes, making it look like she died, to protect her from Maximilian Morel, Monsieur Morel's son, who loves her.
So much manipulation, and it all comes to a head.
At Benedetto's trial for other crimes, the Count arranges for Benedetto to dramatically reveal his true father, Gerard de Villefort.
In open court.
Shattering Villefort's reputation completely. He rushes home, utterly disgraced.
No, I'm like to find more horror.
His wife, fearing exposure, has poisoned their young son, Edouard, and then killed herself, leaving a confession.
Oh, God. The innocent child.
Exactly. Villefort is confronted with his unimaginable scene, his dead child, his dead wife, his career in ruins. And then the Count appears, reveals himself as Dantès.
And Villefort just breaks.
Completely. He descends into madness, loses his mind entirely.
That death of the child, Edouard, that feels different. It's pure collateral damage. How does that affect the Count?
It horrifies him.
Deeply.
This is the moment he truly confronts the limits of his plan, the uncontrollable consequences. He realizes his quest for vengeance has killed an innocent.
It's the turning point where he questions playing God.
Absolutely. He sees the hubris in it. He realizes that manipulating fate can have monstrous, unintended results. It's a moment of profound shock, and I think the beginning of his shift towards something else.
That makes sense. So if we step back and look at the big themes, justice versus vengeance is obviously central. What's Dumas's ultimate take, do you think?
I think he shows that personal vengeance, while maybe understandable, is inherently corrupting. It traps the Count, consumes him, and ultimately causes suffering beyond his targets. True justice remains elusive, perhaps divine.
And the theme of identity, transformation. Dantes becomes the Count, but does Edmund ever truly disappear?
That's a great question. The novel suggests, maybe not entirely, the capacity for mercy, the horror of Edouard's death, the final acts of kindness. Maybe they show the original Edmund reemerging, changed by suffering, but not wholly erased.
It's also such a critique of the systems of power, isn't it? The justice system, the aristocracy.
Definitely. A scathing look at how easily those systems are corrupted by personal ambition, lies, and greed. How fragile justice is when left in human hands.
And there's that idea linking suffering and knowledge. Like Foria, Dantes gains immense wisdom through his ordeal.
Yes, the idea that profound suffering strips away illusions and leads to a deeper understanding of life, of human nature. And from that depth comes the possibility of genuine hope.
Not naive optimism, but earned hope.
Exactly. Which contrasts sharply with the betrayal and greed that drive the villains. Love and loyalty, like morals, like Maximilian and Valentine's, those are presented as the enduring redemptive forces.
Let's talk briefly about how Dumas tells the story, the narration style.
He uses an omniscient third-person narrator, knows everyone's thoughts, secrets.
Which creates that amazing dramatic irony, right? We know who the Count is, but his victims don't, and we're just watching them walk into his traps.
Yes, it ramps up the tension incredibly. And that serial format we mentioned earlier, short chapters, cliffhangers, it makes the plot relentless, intricate.
Dumas is a master plotter. He uses symbolism too, doesn't he?
Oh, constantly. The Chateau d'If tomb and womb, the sea freedom, rebirth, chaos, the treasure that almost divine power to reshape lives.
Foreshadowing, too, like Danglars' early greed.
Pointing towards his eventual ruin through finance. He also uses allusions to myths, the Bible, adding weight, and juxtaposing the glittering surface of society with its rotten core.
So after Edward's death, the Count has this moral epiphany. He realizes he can't be Providence.
Yes, that moment of humility. Only God is all-powerful and all-knowing. He recognizes the danger of his assumed role.
And this leads to his final acts being more about redemption.
I think so. Saving Valentine from Maximilian, ensuring their happiness, leaving them part of his fortune. It's about creating future joy, not just punishing past wrongs.
And he leaves with Haiti.
Yes, she declares her love for him, represents a new future, perhaps. He sails away, leaving his vengeance behind.
Which brings us to that famous final line in his letter to Maximilian.
All human wisdom is contained in these two words. Wait and hope.
Wow. After everything, that's the conclusion he reaches. Not revenge, not despair, but patience and faith.
It's his ultimate transformation, isn't it?
Yeah.
The hard-won lesson from his entire ordeal.
The Count of Monte Cristo really does go beyond just an adventure story. It forces us to think about resilience, justice, mercy.
And it's an incredible story of survival, betrayal, and finding hope against all odds. That's why it still grabs us today, I think. It speaks to something deep in the human spirit.
So a final thought for you listening. When faced with injustice, big or small, how do we walk that line? Between seeking what's fair and finding a way to move forward with peace, this conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.